So just in case any of you don't know me, I doubt that, but I'm Nyaswami Jyotish, and this is Nyaswami Ananta and Nyaswami Devi. And we will be talking this morning on World Brotherhood Colonies as a means of spiritual freedom. The whole World Brotherhood Colony movement that Master started, first in theory, but he actually had, at Encinitas, he had the first of all the World Brotherhood Colonies. It didn't last very long because the world wasn't quite ready for it yet. Even the disciples weren't quite ready for it yet. But nonetheless, as Swami has often said, Master planted that seed in the ether of World Brotherhood Colonies and the importance of them. And I want to talk a little bit this morning about three different aspects of why colonies are so important. The first is satsang, the second is attunement, and the third, I'll come to the third. Save it for a little while. The importance of satsang is much, much greater than what we give credit for, because what the scriptures in the Indian scriptures say is that after the grace of the guru, satsang is the most important thing on the spiritual path. Satsang means sat is truth, sangha means fellowship, so fellowship of truth. So people gathering together in the name of truth, and I want to talk a little bit about that because it is extremely important. We had, a month or so ago, a colony leaders meeting in Palo Alto, where all of the colony leaders from every place except India that didn't have a chance to come over, but even Anand and Kirtani were here from Italy. We gathered together to talk about a whole variety of things, of ways to improve the way that we can work with people, ways to improve Sunday service and classes and what works and what doesn't work and so on. But one of the things that came up and was both in that gathering and over the last many years has been a recurring theme whenever groups are gathered together to talk about how we can spread and how we can intensify and do a better job of doing classes and meditation groups and centers and colonies. The theme that comes up over and over again is how do we keep people inspired and engaged over the long range? Because we see many, many people who come and they are attracted to the teachings for a variety of reasons. Maybe they're stressed out and they want to come and learn some techniques to help deal with their stress. Maybe they have a devotional nature and they're drawn in that way. For a large variety of reasons, they come, they make a first contact, they take some classes, they are drawn in, but the conflicting cross currents of the world with so many pulls and so many needs and desires and necessities and responsibilities and kids to the soccer game and the boss needs to have this project done, and pretty soon you don't see them again. It's not so bad that we don't see them again. It's that God doesn't see them again for quite a long time because they just get absorbed or reabsorbed in the tumult, the storms of the world. It takes a long time to regain some kind of momentum again. It's even more difficult for many people to come back a second time than it is to start off of that original flow of inspiration. They read a book, the first time they're very inspired, they come, and then they, after that, it's if they drop back, pull back from that, it's a little harder to get re-inspired or to get re-engaged again. Many years ago, when Davy and I were starting the San Francisco ashram, we did a number of things, but among other things is that we taught around San Francisco in various venues. And one time we were giving a series of classes in a very large Unitarian church, and they had not only our class, but 8 or 10 classes going on simultaneously every night. So it was the beginning of the first class, and Davy was out at a little registration table, and these two kind of society ladies, nicely dressed, came up and said, "Oh, what's this class?" And she said, "Oh, it's a class in how to meditate." And one of them said, "Oh, meditation, we already did that one." And so once somebody thinks that they've already done the God thing, it's harder for them to re-engage again, because the mind is such that even the briefest little glimpse of something, many people think they know the scope of it. And it might take many, many incarnations for a person like a stone skipping across the surface of a pond. I think my record is 14 skips, you know. I don't know that you want 14 incarnational skips before you sink down into the lake. But nonetheless, it takes a long time for the soul to skip just touching briefly on something before they really engage. But once they begin to engage, what are the forces that allow them to stay engaged? Well, as the scriptures say, the very strongest force of all is the grace of the guru. There are multiple reasons for that. One is that the guru comes and they have always a certain soul connection with the people who are drawn to them. Master said that no one even crossed his path whose karma it was not, who didn't have the karma to do that. So even crossing the path and seeing the guru is an extremely important event. When Edgar Cayce did some readings for people, for many of them, the most important event in many, many incarnations was that they had seen Jesus even from a distance. And so the touch, the magnetic power of the guru is most important. It doesn't have to be a physical touch. Most of us, our first touch was probably the autobiography of a yogi. And when Swamiji said to Master, "It's such a wonderful book," Master said, "Yes, I put my vibrations into it." And that vibrations on a subtle level comes and touches our consciousness in ways that we don't even know, because it's not logical, it's not on the level of the rational mind, but it's a powerful, powerful touch. But that is one prime influence. Nonetheless, there are other influences. For most of us, unless we keep up a very conscious practice, and I'm going to come to that in a moment, a very conscious practice of staying in touch with the guru, that relationship begins to fade. I've always enjoyed a very interesting visual, example or teaching of Master. He said that when a soul first comes onto the spiritual path consciously in any given life, he said the soldiers of his past incarnations and his past efforts of seeking God, they come to the fore. And those soldiers, that's why many people have deeper experiences in the first few months than they might have for years and years afterwards. So those karmic soldiers come to the fore and they help in that early stage, like the beachhead at Normandy. But then they withdraw. And then there's the long work of the soul in that incarnation, putting out the effort to draw closer and closer to God. What is that effort, and why is it that we should even have to put it out? Because in our karmic influence, in our karmic past, there are many, many threads that call on us. You've all felt it yourself. One thread is calling you to, be successful at something. Another thread is calling you to do some form of art. So you have thousands and thousands and thousands of karmic seeds in the astral spine that are waiting for the proper soil, the proper environment to sprout and to grow into a garden. Some of those gardens are beautiful, and some of them are full of noxious weeds. Most of them, in fact, are for the devotee. Even the beautiful ones can be a diversion. And so the question comes then, how do we keep motivated and how do we keep focused? The answer to that, the most powerful answer to that, is satsang, the gathering together with other devotees or other truth seekers. I'm reading a book now that I can't recommend it. I'm not far enough into it to recommend it, and even if I were far enough, I'm not sure I would. At any rate, for those of you whose curiosity is aroused, it's called Rapt, R-A-P-T, and it's a book about the power of the attention and how when the attention becomes highly focused, it has a great, great deal of power to it. It talks about geniuses, and one of the reasons that geniuses are able to do what they're able to do is that their minds become focused and they stay with those projects with deeply focused attention for a long period of time. And gave several examples, but someone who's focused on something and doesn't sleep for 5 or 6 days because their mind is so concentrated on that. When Swamiji writes, that's one of the aspects of Swamiji's genius, is that when he gets focused on something, he gets intensely focused on it, even to the consternation of his friends, because he'll be writing a book, as he did recently with his most recent book was Living Wisely, Living Well, or Do It Well in its earlier incarnation. And as he was writing that, an idea would occur to him at 2 or 3 in the morning, and he didn't want to lose it, so he'd get up and write it down. Then he'd be writing in the middle of the night. And so the mind gets concentrated on something and stays with that. That is how something is taken to a very, very high level. Well, most of us have not developed our powers of concentration to that level, not just over the moment, but over a longer period of time. But how do we begin that process of concentrating on that level? How do we get the mind so that its attention is rapt on one thing at a time? We have to direct it to do that. We have to bring the mind back to focusing on one thing at a time and focusing deeply on that. That's why it would be a very good idea to throw away your text messaging machines, set them aside at least while you're trying to focus on something. Don't check your email every 3 minutes while you're trying to do some other task. The world right now is in an extraordinarily unbalanced timing where people are multitasking. I read something that was very telling. I think it was the man who started Google, and he came into a meeting with a very high-level journalist, somebody like from Newsweek or Time, and while the interviewer was interviewing him, he was text messaging the entire time. And the interviewer said, you know, it would be a much better interview if you would put aside the machine for your phone for a few minutes while we conduct the interview and we can concentrate on it. And he said, I always work this way, take it or leave it. And so that mindset, the world is getting more and more kind of revved up and into microseconds, and the ability to concentrate deeply and go into something at the depth that's necessary for real success is being challenged right now. I won't go on with the negative aspects because there are hundreds and hundreds of current challenges to a person trying to lead a spiritual life, a deeply spiritual life. Someone who wants to turn not just a little bit of their attention to God, but turn the whole of their attention to God. As Swami starts out the Nayaswami vows, from now on I embrace as the only purpose of my life the search for God. So how do we get from a world of restlessness and distraction into embracing as the only purpose of our lives the search for God? We have to concentrate on God. And in order to do that, the magnetic influences around us are of supreme importance. After the guru, not just satsang, but sangha, whatever sangha you have, whatever fellowship you have, is going to largely determine where your consciousness goes. And if you choose that sangha to be something other than God reminding and God reinforcing, then that is the direction that your life is going to go. So we have to concentrate more, and we have to learn to bring the mind back more and more toward God. I just read a delightful little kind of pamphlet by Frank Laubach, who was a Christian missionary. Swami met him and was very, very highly impressed. He really was a saint. He worked in the Philippines for many, many years and started a program called Each One, Teach One, where a literate person would teach another person how to read and write. And in this way, millions and millions of people became literate from that energy that he started. But more than that, he was deeply focused on God because his early ministry didn't go very well. He wasn't very accepted. He had a lot of time on his hands, and he decided to use that time to think about Christ. And gradually he trained himself to think more and more about Christ until there was no time when a part of his mind was not engaged with Christ. Until he said, he was typing and he was saying that Christ uses my fingers to type. Everything that I do, Christ is doing through me. Anyway, the little booklet that I've been reading is A Game of Minutes, he calls it. It's very inspiring. The challenge is very simple. He challenges us to spend 1 second each minute thinking about God. Now, we can do it in a variety of ways. Master talked about the power of bringing the consciousness to the point between the eyebrows. He said, in fact, the fastest method of moving toward God is to keep your consciousness constantly there. Why? This is the God center. In kind of mystical literature, the point between the eyebrows is where Krishna resides. It's Christ consciousness. So energetically bringing your consciousness here, mentally thinking of Christ or Master or God in some form, emotionally letting your heart's energy move toward God for 1 second each minute. He said, gave the example that he did this challenge during a Sunday service where the service was about this. The pastor introduced the game. Everybody had a piece of paper, and they were supposed to mark down whether in that minute or not they thought of God, even though the sermon was on that. Many people didn't get over six 6 minutes out of the entire hour. So 1 out of 10 minutes, even when the subject was talking about God, their mind wasn't on God. But it's a very, very powerful technique, and I've been using it lately. So it can be a variety of ways. You know, you can have a thought about Master. You can look, see his picture, consciously connect with him. You can do a chant. I don't count it if it's just rolling in the background and I'm not even conscious that I'm chanting. But every time I get conscious of the chant, that counts for a connection. And so in a variety of ways, also just trying to send energy here, in a variety of ways it works. Now, what's important is to get the flow of energy upward in the proper direction. And that's what satsang does, because we reinforce that positive flow of energy in each other. And as that energy flows upward toward this Christ center or toward this spiritual center, then it changes our consciousness and it changes our life. And minute by minute, hour by hour, year by year, we're changed. Master said the minutes are more important than the years. So turning our thoughts toward God, and satsang, World Brotherhood communities, set up an environment that optimizes the movement of that consciousness. That's in part why they're so important. We're just barely scratching the surface with Ananda, beautiful though it is and powerful though all of the colonies and the worldwide work is, we're just barely scratching the surface. Now, the second point that I wanted to make was that the attunement that we get from doing this, the attunement with Master. So first, most powerful thing is the magnetism of the guru. Well, how do we get that magnetism? We get that magnetism primarily by attuning our will with the will of the guru. That has to be done on a daily basis. It has to be done in meditation. We should never leave the morning meditation without consciously praying to Master to help us keep our will constantly attuned to him. Our will, our thoughts, our feelings, always in alignment with his will. That minute by minute brings us individually into alignment with him. But also he came with a broad mission, a mission for the whole world. One could say beyond the world, a mission for the whole yuga of Dwapara Yuga, which was to help people move into a greater alignment with God. And as part of that, he spoke very, very, very strongly about the importance of World Brotherhood colonies. And he said, as most of you know, that farther on into Dwapara Yuga, this idea will spread like wildfire, and there will be thousands and thousands of World Brotherhood colonies, places where people come together and live and work together and inspire each other to think more about God, to serve more about God, to do something that brings God more presently into the world. Swamiji one time was asked, what's the purpose of Ananda? And he said something that was startling, especially 20 or 25 years ago. He said, Ananda is here to help balance the world on the spiritual plane. Now, that doesn't mean that just the little group of 1,000 of us are going to overcome the royal of the 6 billion people of the world that have their minds on something other, lots of something others. But what it does mean is that by providing a very clear and very powerful example of what a life lived for God looks like, this community, Swamiji, when he went around the community yesterday, he had tears in his eyes because of the beauty of the community, how much is happening, but most of all, the beauty of the people living here. Many, many people come onto the property and feel completely changed without ever talking with anybody. There's a magnetism and a power that grows. That power is growing and growing. And it's not that we're big, but we're important in the sense that people need a model that they can turn their consciousness toward and see something clearly, because if it's vague, they can't really relate. Then I wanted to end with the final point that I wanted to make, and that's that these World Brotherhood colonies are of great, great service to the planet at this time. I was thinking about some of the basic needs of people, even beyond people, into the higher animal kingdom. And there are some of the obvious needs, you know, the need to for survival, the need for shelter and home of somewhere, some kind, the need for food and so on. But I was thinking in a broader sense, and there is another need that is omnipresent, and that is the need to be useful in some way. Isn't that true? All of us have within our hearts somehow the feeling that our life isn't worth very much unless we're able to be useful in some way. That's what drives us much more than money or status or any of the other secondary things. It's what drives us to want to do things, to take on jobs, to take on projects, that desire to be useful to other people and to the world. As the consciousness becomes more and more refined, that desire becomes more and more refined, so that for us, the desire somehow to be individually helpful to the rest of mankind becomes not just a kind of subliminal thought or something on the back burner of our consciousness. It becomes almost the driving force. After the desire to be close to God, the desire to be of service somehow to Him and to all mankind becomes preeminent. And colonies, World Brotherhood colonies, give us the venue to be able to do that in an effective way. So that through our group magnetism, individual effort counts for a great deal, but it will not change the world unless God is working very, very powerfully through you, unless you're an avatar. But group magnetism and group energy, even of relatively small groups, has the power to change the world. The Renaissance artists changed the world. Scientific invention and the early scientists changed the world. A few people gathered together and focusing their energy has the power to move the world in ways that are extraordinarily beneficial. And believe me, there are other groups out there that want to gather together and move the world in a downward direction. We all know it. And we've all seen it, and we've all seen the tragedy that results from that. There has to be the balancing influence of groups of people gathered together to uplift each other and uplift the world. And that is in part why Master talked so often and so powerfully about the urgent need for these World Brotherhood colonies. And we're very, very, very blessed to be able to be a part of this.